hung at his waist. He looked straight ahead, refusing to meet my gaze. Perhaps not. Desarme has known from the beginning that I was part of your game. It is which part that he has not known. And that had comprised the greatest part of his pleasure, the endeavour to extract that knowledge. I felt a pang of sorrow at the idea of losing him as a patron. He had been my first. "Then you will go to him," Delaunay said. "Ganelon de la Courcelle ails, and time grows short. Let it be done."
"There is no assignation?"
He shook his head. "I would sooner surprise him with it. Do you think he will see you uninvited?"
I thought of Childeric Desarme, the gifts he had sent after the time he had burned me. "Oh yes, my lord, he will see me. And what bait is it I am to dangle?"
The lines of Delaunay's face grew stern, sterner than Jocelyn Varay's in all his disapproval. "Bid him to tell Duke Barquier Lambert that I know who killed his sister." Chapter 28. Delaunay wasted no time dispatching me on the errand that very day. Desarme had quarters in the palace, in addition to his house in the city, and I had met him there before. It pleased him at times to flaunt me under the noses of his peers, but I had never sought him out. I had never sought out any of my patrons, and it was strange to be doing so. In the coach, Jocelyn was as silent as Guy had ever been, but a good deal more noticeable, despite his subdued castelline attire. That he despised me, I had no doubt. Resentment at the role into which he had been forced shouted from every line of his body, glared from his summer blue eyes. I did my best to ignore him, having considerably more important matters on my mind than his impaired dignity, but it wasn't easy. We made a strange couple entering the west wing of the palace. I wore the sanglois cloak over my gown, a modest one of brown velvet, and had my hair caught up in a black mesh caul, but I might as well have come tumbled straight from the bedchamber. Next to Jocelyn's solemn height, ashen garb, and plain steel vambraces, everything about me cried servant of Nama. I tried to determine if he had ever been in the royal palace before, and failed. If he was overwhelmed by its majesty and its bustle, he didn't let it show. At Desarme's quarters, the servant who answered the door recognized me and took a step back, startled. I saw his gaze slide sideways to take in the presence of a castellan brother beside me.
"My lady, Phaedra no Delaunay," he said, collecting himself and bowing.
I held no title, but I was of Delaunay's household, and servants found it best to err on the side of caution. I owed that respect to Guy, I thought, and grieved for him.
"My lord Desarme is not expecting you," Desarme's man said cautiously.
"Yes, I know."
Jocelyn Varay would be no help in a matter of protocol. I wrapped the sanglois cloak around me and summoned what dignity I could, raising my chin.
"Will you send to Lord Desarme and ask if he might spare a moment of his time for me?"
"Yes, of course, my lady."
He hastened to usher us into the antechamber. "If you will be seated." I took a seat gracefully, as if I did this sort of thing every day. Jocelyn followed without a word, and remained standing, at ease in the castellan manner, which consisted of a relaxed stance, arms crossed low, hands resting on the hilts of his daggers. I tried to catch his eye, but he gazed straight ahead, scanning the antechamber imperceptibly for danger. In a short while, Childeric Desarme entered with two men-at-arms in attendance, a curious look on his face. Seeing me, he halted.
"Phaedra, what is it?"
I rose only to sink into a low curtsy, holding it until he gestured impatiently at me.
"I've no time for games," he said. "What brings you here? Is it Delaunay?"
"Yes, my lord," I straightened. "May I speak to you in private?"
Desarme glanced at Jocelyn, who stood impassively, and looked at nothing. Desarme's brows rose a fraction.
"Yes, I suppose you may. Come with me."
I followed as he beckoned, and his men stood back and fell in behind me, cutting off Jocelyn's route.
My lord.
The Castlean brother's voice was quiet and even, but it held a tone that stopped even Desarmes in his tracks. He turned around and looked back.
Jocelyn gave his formal bow. I have sworn an oath.
Oaths. Childeric Desarmes' face twisted at the word.
I suppose you have. Accompany her if you must, Castlean.
Another bow. How someone so rigid could make a basis look as fluid as a river bend, I will never know. And Jocelyn stepped to my side.
We retired, the five of us, to Desarmes' receiving room.
He took his chair and drummed his fingers on the armrests, waiting, watching me with his hawk-like gaze. Knowing better than to presume, I remained standing. His men-at-arms flanked him, hands hovering conspicuously over their sword-hilts.
My lord Desarmes.
Uttering the words, I sank down to kneel à béant. It was ingrained in me as deeply as Jocelyn Varay's Castlean watchfulness. My lord de Launay sends me to beg a boon.
A boon? De Launay? Desarmes' eyebrows rose to full arch, all the more marked by the way his taut braid drew back the dark hair from his face. What does he want of me?
One sentence and he would know. I clasped my hands together and fought back another shiver, thankful of Jocelyn's grey-clad legs behind my back. He desires a meeting with Duke Barquier Lanvert. He asks that you act as go-between in this matter.
I looked up as I said it. I saw Desarmes' face change. How does... he began, puzzled.
It changed.
You...
Childeric Desarmes was trained to arms, and a skilled hunter besides. Still, it took me by surprise how swiftly he moved. It shouldn't have. I'd seen from the first the unerring aim with which he toppled the Plastinex in Cecily Laveau-Perrin's game of Cotabos. But I failed to gauge it, and he had me in an instant, back straining beneath his knee, his blade at my throat. I felt it score a fiery line against my skin, and gasped.
All this time, Desarmes hissed, you have played me false. Well, the king maintains his own justice against treachery, and so do I, Fedrano de Launay. There is no contract between us now, and no word you may speak to bind me from acting.
There is one. From my strained position I could see Jocelyn give his damnable bow, only this time his daggers flashed free of their sheaths as he gave it. Carsiel!
Would but I could have seen it clearer.
From the far edges of my vision, I saw Desarmes' men-at-arms step up to the attack. Jocelyn moved calmly, and steel glinted in an intricate pattern. He whirled as smoothly as silk, no haste in his motions, and yet the men-at-arms spun away from him like a child's toys. Desarmes' gold-hilted dagger came away from my throat as he rose. Then Jocelyn moved again, and it was flying through the air with a ringing sound. Desarmes shook his hand and cursed. A line of red scored his palm. Jocelyn bowed and sheathed his daggers.
I protect and serve,
he said without inflection.
Fedrano de Launay was speaking. All right. Desarmes sank back into his chair, waving his scored hand at his men, who staggered to their feet and fumbled for their blades.
The predatory curiosity doubled in Desarmes' gaze, as he watched me collect myself to kneel with some semblance of dignity.
First an Anguisset, now this. He's as real as you are, isn't he? Anafiel de Launay is serious indeed, if he's contracted a Castlean brother as your companion. What makes you suppose I serve Barquier Lanvert?
My lord, you spoke of it. I touched my throat unthinking, feeling a trickle of blood. The night you took up the poker.
Behind me I heard Jocelyn's sharp intake of breath. Whatever his training had prepared him for, it was not this.
Desarmes' brows shot up toward his hairline.
You heard that? He asked, astonishment unfeigned.
From my kneeling position I stared at him, and the red haze clouded my vision. My lord Desarmes, you have known from the first that Anafiel de Launay fished with interesting bait, I said, citing his own words. Did you suppose Cushiel's dart had no barbs? One of the men-at-arms made a sound.
I don't know which. I held Desarmes's gaze as if my life depended upon it, which perhaps it did. After a moment he gave a short laugh.
Bobs, yes.
His mouth twisted wryly.
I've known since that night. Yours were sunk in me. But these you speak of are Delaunay's crafting, and not Cushiel's.
I shook my head. Delaunay taught me to listen, and cast me on the waters. But what I am, I was born.
Desarmes sighed and gestured at a chair.
For Elowa's sake, Fedra, if you would petition me on behalf of a peer, do it seated.
I obeyed, and Desarmes gave his wry smile as he watched Jocelyn move to take up his post at my elbow.
Now what does Anarfiel Delaunay want with Barquier Lanvert, and why on earth should the Duke listen to what he has to say?
What my Lord Delaunay wants I could not say, I said carefully. He holds my mark, and I do as he bids. He does not explain himself to me. I know only what he offers.
Which is?
It was the only card I held, and I hoped I was playing it wisely. Delaunay knows who killed the Duke's sister. Childeric Desarmes sat unmoving. I could trace the play of his thoughts behind his still gaze.
Why does he not take it to the king?
There is no proof.
Then why should the Duke Lanvert believe him?
Because it is true, my lord. I saw as I said it the pattern of Delaunay's plot unfolding before me, and gazed at Desarmes. By the same token by which I know you serve Barquier Lanvert, I swear it is true.
You?
He asked. I shook my head. Not I, but by the same token.
The white-haired boy, it must be.
Desarmes moved restlessly. I sensed rather than saw Jocelyn tense, then relax.
Still, they have been enemies a long time, my Duke and your Lord. Why would Delaunay...
I saw the answer come to him, but he bit it off unspoken, gaze moving from me to Jocelyn.
Delaunay. He uttered it like a curse and sighed. Very well. My lord the Duke would have my head if I didn't bring him word of this. I make no promises, but tell Delaunay I will accede to his request. And unless I am mistaken, the Duke will wish to hear what he has to say.
Yes, my lord, I said, bowing my head. Thank you.
Don't thank me.
Desarmes rose smoothly. Jocelyn shifted, but I motioned him to stillness as Desarmes approached. He traced the line of my cheek with his knuckles, ignoring the castelline.
You will have a great deal to answer for, should I choose to see you again, Fedra no Delaunay,
Desarmes said, making a menacing caress of his voice. I shuddered at his touch, half overcome with desire. Yes, my lord, I whispered, turning my head to kiss his knuckles. His hand shifted, closing hard on the back of my neck. Jocelyn quivered like an overtight bowstring, unsheathing several inches of steel from his daggers. Desarmes gave him an amused look.
"Know what it is you serve, Castelline,"
he said contemptuously, giving my neck a brief hard shake. I drew in a sharp breath, not exactly in pain.
"You'll need a strong stomach if you're to be companion to an Anguissette."
Releasing me, Desarmes stepped back. His men eyed Jocelyn warily, but the Castelline merely bowed, his face like stone.
"Tell Delaunay he will hear word,"
Desarmes said to the both of us, bored by his own game.
"Now get out of my sight."
Escorted by his men-at-arms, we obeyed quickly. Indeed, Jocelyn couldn't oblige him quickly enough. The moment the door to Desarmes's quarters closed behind us, he turned on me livid with revulsion.
"You call that?" he said savagely. "You call that service to Elowa and his companions? It's bad enough what most of your kind do in Nama's name, but that—"
"No," I hissed, cutting him off and grabbing his arm. A pair of passing couriers turned to look. "I call that service to an Anarfiel Delaunay, who owns my mark," I said in a low tone. "And if it is offensive to you, then I suggest you take it up with your prefect, who ordered you into the same service. But whatever you do, Do not blather it about the halls of the palace."
Jocelyn's blue eyes widened, and white lines formed at the sides of his nobly shaped nose. Effortlessly, he pulled his arm free of my grip.
"Come on,"
he said in a tight voice, turning to stride down the hall. I had to hurry to catch him, cursing under my breath. At least he was easy enough to keep in sight, the dim grey robe of his Mandilian coat swinging with the speed of his pace, the hilt of his broadsword rising over his shoulder, and the blonde hair clubbed at his neck. If we had looked a sight entering together, side by side, I couldn't imagine how much stranger it looked to have me chasing after him as we left.
"Fedra."
A woman's voice, low and rich, with a hint of laughter in it like music. It was the only one I knew that could stop me in my tracks, my head turning like it was on a string. Melisande Shahrazai stood with two peers just inside an arched doorway. I approached at her beckon, while she bid farewell to the two lords with whom she had been conversing.
"What brings you to the palace, Fedra no Delaunay?"
With a smile she reached out to stroke the scratch Desson's dagger had scored on my throat.
"On Arfiel's business, or Namar's?"
"My lady," I said, struggling for reserve, "you must ask it of my lord, and not me."
"I shall when I see him."
Melisande ran a fold of my sangwar cloak through her fingers.
"Such a beautiful color. I'm glad he found someone who could recreate the old dye. It suits you."
She watched me with amusement, as if she could see the pulse quicken in my veins.
"I mean to visit soon. I've been in Kushith, but I heard of your household's misfortune. Convey my regards to that sweet boy, will you? Alcuin, isn't it?"
I would bet my mark she had no doubt of his name. The number of people outside Delaunay's household who even knew of the attack could be numbered on one hand.
"I will, my lady. Gladly."
Footsteps sounded behind us, quick and sure. I saw Melisande's graceful brows arch and turned to see Jocelyn, frowning. He made a swift bow and rose with hands resting on his dagger hilts, standing at ease by my right elbow. Melisande glanced from my face to his, then back again, framing a question.
"You?" she asked me, astonished. "The Castellan brother serves you?"
I opened my mouth to reply, but Jocelyn's bow and answer came quicker.
"I protect and serve," he said flatly.
It was the only time I ever saw Melisande Shahrazai startled into true laughter. It rang from the vaulted roof of the salon, free and spontaneous.
"Oh, an Arfiel Delaunay!"
she gasped, gaining composure and wiping her eyes with a lace-edged kerchief.
"You priceless man! No wonder! Ah, well!"
The white lines were back at the sides of Jocelyn's nose, and I could nearly hear his teeth grind. As if oblivious to his discomfort, Melisande patted his cheek, then traced a line on his chest with one finger.
"It seems the Castellan Brotherhood has been robbing the Night Court's cradles," she murmured, regarding him.
He stared over her shoulder, the blood rising in a tide to heat his face.
"Lucky brethren."
I thought Jocelyn might well explode, but he held his stance fixedly and stared into the distance. It is a long discipline, the Castellan training. Even Melisande Shahrazai couldn't breach it with a touch. No, it would take somewhat more, I wagered. 5 minutes, perhaps even 10.
"Well, then,"
her eyes sparkled with the aftermath of laughter, a darker blue than Jocelyn's, the starry hue of sapphires.
"You will carry my regards to Alcuin, and my everlasting admiration to Delaunay?"
I nodded. She had not given me the kiss of greeting, but she kissed me now in farewell, knowing it would set me off balance with Jocelyn watching. It did.
"Who," he said when she had left us, "is that?"
I cleared my throat. "The Lady Melisande Shahrazai."
"The one who testified against House Trevelyan?"
He continued to gaze after her. I was surprised he knew that much about the affairs of the realm. He shuddered as if shaking off a spell.
I actually sympathized with him for a moment.
"Will you be leaving now?"
he asked then, polite and toneless. He had defaulted on his duty once through haste, I thought. It would not happen again. My feeling of sympathy evaporated.
Chapter 29. When we returned, Delaunay was waiting for us in his receiving room, unusual in itself. I wondered if the formality was for Jocelyn's benefit, and grew further irritated with him to think it. Alcuin was there, sitting cross-legged and quiet on a low couch. He had been watching Delaunay pace for the better part of an hour, I guessed.
"Well?" Delaunay asked as we entered. "Will he do it?"
As I made ready to speak, once again Jocelyn beat me to it.
"My lord," he
said in his most impassive voice, unbuckling his baldric and slinging the sheathed sword off his shoulder,
"I have failed in your service. I beg you to accept the blade of this unworthy one."
I stared at him open-mouthed as he went to one knee before Delaunay and proffered the blade across the back of his vam-braced left arm. Even Delaunay looked startled.
"What in Elowa's name are you talking about?" he asked. "Phaedra looks well enough to me, and I ask no more than that."
"Show him," Jocelyn said, not looking at me.
"What, this?" I touched the trickle of blood that had dried at my throat and laughed, uncomprehending. "From Childeric de Somme, this is no more than a love-scratch, my lord," I said to Delaunay, "and it was Jocelyn kept him from giving me worse."
"De Somme grew violent toward you?"
Delaunay raised his eyebrows. "When he learned that I had betrayed his patronage to you. But Jocelyn—"
"He laid a blade against her and drew blood,"
Jocelyn interrupted me, adamant in his profession of guilt.
"I failed in my warding, and then in my anger, I let her out of my sight."
I caught Delaunay's inquiring glance. "Melisande." Her name sufficed as explanation. "She sends her greetings, and her regrets upon your injury," I added to Alcuin. To Delaunay, I said, compelled by fairness, "Jocelyn did not fail you. He protected me well. Desson took him by surprise, that's all." Jocelyn didn't rise, still holding out his sword, head bowed.
"I have never drawn blade against any, save on the practice field," he murmured. "I was unready. I am unworthy."
Delaunay drew a deep breath, then released it.
"An untried castellan," he muttered. "I should have known the prefect would salt his gift thusly. Well, lad, I have measured your skill myself on the practice field, and if you succeed thus well against Childeric de Somme, unready and untried on the proving ground of d'Angeline intrigue, I am not displeased."
Jocelyn's head came up, blue eyes blinking. He tried to offer his sword once more. Delaunay shook his head.
"To fail and persevere is a harder test than any you will meet on the practice field. Keep your sword. I cannot afford its loss."
Dismissing the matter, he turned his gaze back to me.
"Now what of the Duke Lambert?"
"Desson was convinced," I said, unclasping my cloak and taking a seat, "as you intended. He will convey your request, and convey word if Lambert accedes."
"Good."
A measure of tension left Delaunay. I wished I knew what it was he had invested in this. Retribution against Vital Bouvard and the Stregardzer, of course. Any fool could guess as much. But why? He had sought it even before Guy's death and Alcuin's injury. In the silence, Jocelyn rose and strapped on his baldric, slinging the sword back over his shoulder. Two spots of colour glowed on his cheeks, and shame made his movements awkward. I nearly pitied him again. The motion caught Delaunay's eye.
"You are dismissed," he said, nodding with absent courtesy.
"My lord," I said, "now that—"
"No," he cut me off, "no assignations, not until I have met with Barquiel Lambert. We have shaken the game board, and I will take no risks until the players have realigned."
I sighed. "As you will, my lord." Once again I was condemned to a life of tedium. As if to make matters worse, Alcuin and Jocelyn struck up a friendship. It began watching Jocelyn at his morning exercises, a novelty which paled quickly for me,
I was willing to admit it was a thing of beauty to behold, but even the most avid music lover tires of hearing the same song. But Alcuin's fascination endured. One afternoon, drawn by the clatter, I walked onto the terrace of the rear garden to find them sparring with wooden practice swords, the kind boys use at play. To my surprise, Jocelyn was a gentle and patient teacher. He never laughed at Alcuin's clumsy efforts to thrust and parry, but waited on him when he lost his grip, demonstrating strokes over and over again in slow, flowing movements. Alcuin followed his lead with a good will, never out of temper, laughing at his own mistakes, and stranger indeed, Jocelyn sometimes laughed with him.
"I should have known," Delaunay murmured at my elbow.
I hadn't heard him come on to the terrace. His gaze tracked their progress.
A pity it's too late for him to learn it, in truth. Alcuin's temperament is better suited to the Castlean Brotherhood than the service of Namar.
It must have been he who gave them permission, and the wooden blades. "He is not suited to the Castlean Brotherhood, my lord," I said sharply, rendered out of sorts by their laughter. "After all, he is in love with you."
"Alcuin?" Delaunay's voice rose and he blinked at me. "You cannot mean it. If anything, I have stood as a father to him, or at the least, an uncle."
"There is no folly like the folly of the wise." I eyed him wryly. "My lord, if you believe that, I have a vial of the Magdalene's tears I would sell you. You are Alcuin's rescuer from sure death, as you are mine from ignominy, and you could have either one of us by crooking your smallest finger. But I have watched Alcuin, and he would happily die for you. There is no one else in the world for him."
It was something, at least, to see Delaunay dumbstruck.
I sketched him a curtsy which he did not see, and took my leave with haste. "Alcuin," I thought, sorrow in my heart, "never say I have not done you a kindness. If my lord will not have you, at least he cannot plead ignorance as an excuse." After that I could not stay in the house. Let Delaunay stripe my hide if he would, which I knew he would not. But if I was forbidden the service of Namar, I had to escape from this eternal confinement. With everyone at the rear of the house, it was easy enough to slip out through the side gate. I had the sense to take my brown cloak and not the sanguar, and to bring some few coins that had not gone to pay the markist. It was a simple matter to pay coach fare to Knight's doorstep. For a smile, the coachman undercharged me. Hyacinth was not at home, but I endured his mother's too knowing stare, and found him quickly enough at the Cockerel, dismissing the coach. After long days of tedium, my heart leapt at the rollicking music and blazing light spilling out onto the street. I entered into pandemonium, its apparent source a game of dice at the back of the inn. A mass of guests was clustered about a table, most dressed in courtier's finery, while a fiddler played on the dais. Below his frantic playing, I heard the sound of dice rattling in the cups being cast upon the table. Groans rose from some of the watchers, and shouts from others, and ringing over them all, a familiar triumphant cry. The crowd dispersed to mill around the inn, and I saw Hyacinth with several of his friends about him, grinning as he swept his winnings into a pile. "Phaedra!" he shouted, seeing me. Shoving the coins into his purse, he vaulted over a chair to greet me. I was so happy to see him, I threw both arms around his neck. "Where have you been?" he laughed, returning my embrace, then holding my shoulders to look at me. "I've missed you. Was Guy so wroth after the last time that Delaunay wouldn't let you come?"
"Guy,"
the word caught in my throat. I had forgotten for a moment. I shook my head. "No, I've a lot to tell you."
"Well, come in, sit down. I'll clear those louts away from the table."
He flashed his grin, teeth white against his dark skin. He was wearing finer clothes than before, in a wild array of colour, a blue doublet with gold brocade on the front, and saffron sashes in the sleeves, over scarlet hosen, and looked absolutely splendid to my eyes.
"I'll buy us a jug of wine." "Namar's tits, I'll buy everyone a jug of wine."
He shouted to the innkeeper,
"Wine for everyone!"
Good-natured cheers rose, and Hyacinth laughed, sweeping a bow. No question that they loved him here, and no question why. If the Prince of Travellers won more at dice than an honest man ought, he returned 9 centimes out of 10 in his extravagance, and no one grudged him the 10th part. I never knew if he cheated or not. Tsingani are reputed to be lucky. Of course, they are also reputed to cheat, lie, and steal with considerable skill, though I have never known Hyacinth to do worse than filching tarts from the pastry vendors in the market. His friends made room for us at the table, and the noise made a shield for conversation, as I told him all that had happened. Hyacinth listened without comment, shaking his head when I was done.
"Delaunay's mixed up in House Corsell's business, that's for sure," he said. "I wish I could tell you how. I found a poet who'd a friend with a copy of Delaunay's verses, you know."
"You did?" My eyes widened. "Can you—"
"I tried."
Hyacinth's tone was regretful. He sipped his wine. He'd sold them not a month prior, to a Caerdicky archivist. "I would have bought them for you, Fedra, I swear it, or a fair copy at least. But my friend's friend swore he sold the original and kept no copy. Too dangerous, he deemed it." I made a noise of disgust. "It doesn't make any sense. Why does House Corsell aid him with one hand and gag him with the other?"
"Well, you know why they gag him."
Hyacinth leaned back in his chair, propping his boot heels on the table. "He blackened their faces when he made a song about Isabelle Lanvers. I heard the Lioness of Azal named her a murderess in front of the High Court."
"She did. I remember Dissandre de la Corselle casting her vote for death.
So why aid him?"
There were too many threads, too tangled to sort. "Four. I've no head for riddles, and had naught to do for days on end but think on them.
If you were truly my friend, you'd ask me to dance," I said, teasing him.
"There is someone who will be jealous if I dance with you," he said, a gleam in his eyes.
He nodded to a woman across the inn, a cool blonde in an ice-blue gown. Cool as her demeanour was, I saw indeed that she smouldered to watch us.
"Do you care?" I asked him.
Hyacinth laughed and shook his head, black ringlets dancing.
"She is wed to a baronet," he said, grinning, "and if I have danced with her before, it does not mean I will dance to her every tune."
He took his feet off the table and rose, bowing and extending his hand.
"Will you do me the honour?"
The fiddler doubled his vigour to see us join the dancing, winking at Hyacinth, and we danced with good will. It brought more guests onto the floor, and with the exception of the baronet's sulky wife and a couple of her companions, everyone not dancing laughed and clapped the time. I danced twice with Hyacinth, then one each with several of his friends, and then the fiddler struck up a switch-reel, and everyone traded partners in a rush, whirling from one to the next, while those not dancing hastily moved chairs out of the way. When it was done, we were all breathless and flushed with merriment, and the fiddler bowed with a gasp, stepping down to wipe his brow and catch his wind with a mug of ale. We had not yet taken our own seats when a commotion from the street drew a handful of people outside. A slight young man with curly hair darted in to catch Hyacinth's sleeve.
"Hyas, come on, you've got to see this," he said, laughing. "It's better than baiting badgers."
Hyacinth looked inquiringly at me.
"Why not?" I agreed, high-spirited and ready for anything. A crowd of spectators had already gathered along the sides of the street, watching the entertainment taking place in the middle of it, but Hyacinth pushed his way through to a stack of empty wine barrels and upended one that we might stand upon it and gain a good view. I saw and groaned in dismay. It was a party of drunken young nobles, perhaps a dozen lords and ladies in all, returning to Montnouy with 4 adepts from Eglantine House, whom I knew by the green and gold of their attire. Their open carriage was turned sideways across the street, blocking the passage, and a distance behind it the young lords ranged in a semicircle with hilarious expressions and drawn swords. In the centre of the space they had created was one very uncomfortable young Castellane brother, being taunted mercilessly by the Eglantine adepts.
"Jocelyn," I sighed.
An Eglantine flautist perched on the back of the carriage, playing a merry, skillful tune, while another adept sang unabashedly bawdy lyrics, her well-trained voice so lovely it took a moment for listeners to realize the vulgarity of her song. The other two Eglantines were tumblers, male and female, and it was they who pressed Jocelyn the hardest. As I watched, the male tumbler knelt, and the female sprang off the balls of her feet in a neat somersault, landing atop his shoulders. He stood as she straddled his neck, and her rising cleavage was thrust nearly under Jocelyn's nose. His face, a study, he took a step backward, only to be prodded forward by the points of the lordling's swords. The female tumbler stood atop her partner's shoulders, and he placed his hands beneath her feet, aiding her with a boost as she somersaulted over Jocelyn's head. The male promptly went to a handstand, wrapping his ankles around Jocelyn's neck and hanging suspended, ducking his head between the Castellan's legs and grinning at the cheering crowd. With a look of disgust, Jocelyn pried the tumbler's crossed ankles loose, and the Eglantine caught himself on his hands, rolling and bounding to his feet. Jocelyn took a step in the direction of the carriage, only to be confronted by the other tumbler, who leapt up to wrap her slim legs around his waist, grabbing his face in both hands and kissing him. Disengaging himself from her, he turned back toward the lordlings, laughing faces and gleaming steel arrayed against him. The male tumbler snuck up behind him, pulling a pin from his neatly clubbed hair. A swatch of wheat-blonde hair trailed loose.
"Name of Eloa," I muttered. "If you won't draw your sword, at least use your daggers, you idiot."
"He can't," Hyacinth said beside me, eyes bright with amusement. "They're just having fun, and Castellans take an oath to draw steel only to defend their lives or protect their companions." I sighed again. "I suppose I have to do it, then." Before Hyacinth could protest, I hopped down from the barrel and squirmed my way through the crowd, stumbling into the open street in front of the sword-baiting lordlings. Jocelyn caught sight of me with a startled look, and the flautist missed a beat.
"Leave off!" one of the young lords complained, catching my arm and trying to pull me away. "We're just having fun with him."
I raised my arm, his hand still gripping it. "Jocelyn, serve and protect?" His vambraces flashed as he bowed, and both daggers rang free from their sheaths. I don't think he'd taken two steps before the lordling dropped my arm and the others began backing away, hastily sheathing their steel. The Eglantine flautist continued to play, no less merry with this new entertainment, and the singer took up a tambour while the tumblers threw tricks.
"Enough! Enough!" cried one of the ladies of the party,
traces of hilarity still in her voice. She curtsied in Jocelyn's direction. "Cassiel's servant has amused us enough for one evening, I think." His glare could have chiselled stone, but their laughter echoed on the air as they departed. He turned his glare on me instead. "I suppose Delaunay sent you?" I asked reluctantly.
"You are to return with me."
His jaw clenched as he nodded toward Delaunay's coach, parked some distance away. The coachman looked apologetic.
"Forthwith."
Hyacinth leapt down from the barrel and ran over to give me a hasty farewell kiss. "Come when you can," he said, trying not to turn his laughing gaze on Jocelyn, whose expression made it quite clear that that would be never if he had any say in the matter. I prayed he didn't. "I always miss you."
"Me too."
I made a point of kissing him again, grabbing his black ringlets in both hands. "Take care, Prince of Travellers." We didn't speak in the coach, though Jocelyn radiated fury like a forge. His ash-grey clothing had been pulled askew, and a hank of hair fell along his face. I am certain he never in his life imagined a Castellan brother could be subjected to such indignity, and it was obvious that he held me to blame. Which gave me cause to think about facing Delaunay. I did not look forward to it. If I expected to meet Delaunay's cold, implacable anger, I was mistaken, though not through any saving grace of my own.
Jocelyn conducted me to the library, hand at my back, nearly marching me along, and by this time I was sufficiently aware of my guilt to make no protest. But when we arrived, Delaunay merely glanced up, raising a letter in one hand.
"It's come," he said briefly. "Barquiel Lanvert will see me in 2 days' time."
"My lord," I kept my voice steady with an effort, "good news indeed."
"Yes."
He studied the letter as if dismissing us, then looked up again, and this time his gaze held all the emotionless resolve I had feared.
"Fedra, I warned you once. I will not do it again. If you leave these walls again without my permission, I will sell your mark. That is all."
"Yes, my lord." My knees were trembling, and it took all the strength I had to turn and walk out without giving Jocelyn Verrai the satisfaction of seeing it. Before I closed the door behind me, I gained some measure of reparation in hearing Delaunay say to Jocelyn, in quite a different tone,
"What in the seven hells happened to you, lad?"
It was a pity I didn't dare stay to hear his reply.
Chapter 30. There were terms, it seemed, to the Duc Lanvert's agreement. He would meet with Delaunay on his own territory, on the Lanvert estate, an hour's ride outside the city. Not the seat of the duchy, which lay in northern Namur, but a pleasure retreat he used when attendant on the palace. In addition, there was to be an escort of 20 of Lanvert's men-at-arms. The Duke was taking no chances with Delaunay. This much we knew, so it was no surprise when the escort arrived en masse and the captain of Lanvert's guard knocked on the door. Delaunay's horse was saddled and ready. Although Jocelyn was prepared to accompany him, he was minded to go alone. If it went well, he had said, there would be no need of Jocelyn's aid. If it did not, then one Castellan brother alone would not suffice to protect him, not against those odds. A half-dozen might, or even four, but not one. Delaunay's plan, however, was laid in vain. Barquiel Lanvert had made other plans. The captain of the guard looked Delaunay up and down, folding his arms. He wore light chainmail under a tunic of deep purple, with the Lanvert crest on it in gold, a stylized bridge over a fiery river.
"I was told to bring the others." "What others?" "Desarmes girl, and the other, the boy who claims to know."
The captain looked smug. Barquiel Lanvert had done his schoolwork. Delaunay paused, then shook his head.
"I vouch for their word. They stay here." "Then so do you."
Turning on the doorstep, the captain gave his men a hand signal, and they wheeled their mounts.
"Wait,"
Alcuin pushed past Delaunay. "I'll go." He turned before Delaunay could speak. "There is a score to be settled. Do you deny I have the right to be there, my lord?" he asked coolly. He wanted to, I could tell, but it was not in him to deny Alcuin this last ounce of pride.
"Very well."
He gave a brief nod, then looked back at me.
"No, don't even say it."
"My lord," I lifted my chin and gambled, "I have risked as much as anyone to gain you this audience. If you would jeopardize it by going without me, do not think to find me here when you return." Delaunay took a step in my direction and lowered his voice.
"And do not think I will fail to do as I have threatened."
It was hard to look him in the eyes, but I did. "Will you, my lord?" I swallowed, then pressed onward. "To whom? Melisande Charizai, perhaps, who would use me as I've been trained in a game even you cannot guess at?"
"Ah!"
Delaunay threw up his arms in disgust. Behind him I could see bemusement on the captain of the guard's face.
"I taught you too well by half," he snapped at me. "I should have known better than to buy the mark of someone who enjoys risking her life."
He turned to Jocelyn, hovering in the entryway.
"You'll come too, then, Castellan, and ward them both well. By Carsiel's dagger, it's on your head if you don't keep them alive."
Jocelyn made his impassive bow.
but I saw a hint of apprehension flicker in his blue eyes. Still, I had to admit, he made for an impressive companion. The Lanvert captain took a startled step backward when he emerged. The team was hitched to the coach, and Alcuin's horse saddled for Jocelyn in short order, and we were underway, our breath rising in clouds of frost in the chill morning air. The purple and gold Lanvert standard rose above our small party, and the gleaming mail the men-at-arms wore gave us a martially festive air. I was naive enough then to find it thrilling. Besides, four or five of the men, I was sure, were not d'Angeline. They rode with a particularly wary air about them, and dark burnouses wrapped their heads and swathed their faces. The Caliph of Kebel Im Akkad had given Lanvert land and horses and men. I was willing to bet these riders were Arcadian. The Duke Lanvert's country estate was surprisingly charming. I had never been to a country estate, save Perrinwald, but this was no working manor. We crossed a small river. The arched bridge echoed the design on the Lanvert's arms, and rode through fanciful grounds, where gardeners labored over all manner of imported trees, binding them with burlap against the cold. Still, we were seen from the parapets of the modest chateau, there was no doubt of that. The standard-bearer rode a little ahead and hefted the banner three times. There was an answering flash from atop the walls, and the gate was raised to admit us into the courtyard. And if we were politely received, we were nonetheless conducted by our full escort into the Duke's receiving room. The room was beautifully appointed with Arcadian tapestries and furniture of unusual design, low and cushioned. One chair, with carving elaborate enough for a throne, was clearly the Duke's, but it stood empty. One of the men-at-arms, one of those I guessed to be Arcadian, left, while the captain and the others lined the walls and stood at attention. I watched Delaunay, taking my cue from him. He was calm and watchful, betraying no sign of unease. It heartened me to see it. In a few moments we heard the sound of booted strides in the hallway, and the Duke Lanvert entered the room. Though I'd never seen him, I'd no doubt who it was. His men made him instantaneous bows, and Delaunay and the three of us followed suit. To my surprise, when I straightened from my deep curtsy, I saw that the Duke himself was dressed in Arcadian style. A burnouse of Lanvert purple shrouded his face, and instead of a doublet, he wore loose robes over his breeches, with a long, flowing coat. Only his eyes were visible, but I knew them once I had the chance to look him full in the face. They were a deep violet, House Lanvert colouring, the colour of Isandre de la Courcelle's eyes, who was his niece.
"Anofiel Delaunay," the Duke drawled, taking his seat and unwinding the long scarf of his burnous.
He had the white blonde hair, too, and pale skin, though it was sun-darkened around his eyes, and his hair was cropped shorter than I'd ever seen a nobleman's.
"Well, well, so you've come to apologize for your sins against my house?"
Delaunay stepped forward and gave another bow.
"Your Grace," he said, "I have come to propose we put that matter behind us, in the past where it belongs."
Barquiel Lanvert sat at his ease, legs crossed before him, and I did not doubt for an instant that he was a dangerous man.
"After you named my sister a murderess for all the realm to hear," he asked smoothly, "do you suggest I simply forgive this slight?"
"Yes," Delaunay said it without losing an inch of composure. I heard several of the men-at-arms murmur. The Duke raised his hand without looking to see which ones.
"Why?" he asked curiously. "I know what you have to offer, and I wish to hear it. But it settles nothing between us, Delaunay. Why should I forgive?"
Delaunay drew a long breath, and something smoldered in his voice.
"Do you swear, Your Grace, on Elowa's name and your own lineage, that my song was untrue?"
His question hung in the air. Barkiel Lanvert considered it, then moved his head slightly, neither a nod nor a shake.
"I do not swear either way, Delaunay. My sister Isabel was ambitious and jealous in the bargain. But if she had aught to do with Edmé de Rocaille's fall, I will swear she never intended her death."
"The intent does not matter. The cause alone suffices."
"Perhaps," Barkiel Lanvert continued to study him, "perhaps not. Because of your words, a traitress may name my sister a cold-blooded killer to the king's own face, and no one will gainsay it. You have not given me sufficient reason to forgive. Have you more?"
"I have sworn an oath," Delaunay said softly, "by which you stand to profit."
"Oh, that!" Lanvert's voice rose in surprise. He laughed. "You mean to stand by that, after the way Ganelon's treated you?"
"I did not swear it to Ganelon de la Crucelle."
I wished fervently that one of them would say more of the matter, but neither did. Delaunay stood tautly upright, while Lanvert's thoughtful gaze wandered over the three of us, pausing longest on Jocelyn.
"Well, Ganelon takes it with some degree of seriousness, it would seem," he observed, "though I have never seen a stranger retinue. Two whores and a Castelline brother. Only you, Onarfiel. You always had a reputation for being unpredictable, but this is downright eccentric. Which one knows who killed my sister?"
Alcuin stepped forward and bowed. "My lord," he said calmly, "I do." I had never been prouder of him, not even when he made his debut. I could swear he was more composed than Delaunay. Even when Lanvert pinned him with his violet gaze, Alcuin didn't flinch.
"Do you?" the Duke mused. "Which one of the Stregadze was it, then?"
He saw a flicker of consternation on Alcuin's face and laughed.
"I have ears in the city, boy. If Isabel was killed, it had to be by poison, and no true d'Angeline would resort to such means. I hear tell you were attacked, and one man killed. Now Vital Bouvard, who trades with the Stregadze, is nowhere to be found, and I hear from Desson he paid an unheard-of sum for your virgin price. Who was it?"
One flicker was all the Duke would get out of Alcuin. He looked to Delaunay as coolly as could be. "My lord?"
Delaunay nodded. "Tell him."
"Dominic and Thérèse," Alcuin stated simply. I'd not seen the face of a man deciding to kill before, but I saw it then. A stillness came over Barkiel Lanvert, a look of intensity and hunger all at once. He sighed, and there was release in it.
"Did Bouvard offer proof?"
"No," Alcuin shook his head. "He had none, but he carried a gift of candied figs from the Stregadze to Isabel de la Courcelle. They were put in his hand by Dominic, but it was Thérèse who knew how she loved them. Bouvard delivered them himself."
"There was an empty salver in her rooms," Lanvert said, remembering. "I suspected, we all did, but no one knew what had been in it, nor from whence it came."
"He tried to tell me it was Lionette de Trevelyan," Alcuin murmured, "but I laughed and guessed it for a lie. It was too safe an answer, as she no longer lived to refute it. I do not think he would have tried to kill me, nor fled the country, had he lied the second time."
"You knew I have a cousin who has some sway in La Serenissima," Lanvert said to Delaunay. "My arm is longer than yours, and considerably more powerful, yes? But why do you care who killed Isabel? I might almost have thought you'd seek allies among them." "You insult me," Delaunay said, flushing with anger. "If Isabel and I were enemies, you know well the only weapon I wielded against her was words." "All too well. Why do you care who killed her?" "Did you know that Dominic and Thérèse Stregadze have four children? All of the blood by way of descent, and all fostered in one of the d'Angeline great houses.
Yes, and Prince Benedict is yet hale, whereas the king's health fails, and his brood is powerful in La Serenissima, while certain parties whisper in certain circles that Baudouin de Trevelyan was innocent, and the Dauphine's name is sullied by virtue of the slur with which her mother's was tainted. Barquiel Lambert rested his chin on one fist. Will you teach me to play the Game of Thrones?
I think not, Delaunay.
No, Your Grace, and I have not yet congratulated you on the marriage of your daughter, Delaunay added with a bow.
Indeed.
A brief smile touched Lambert's face. Well, perhaps you're right. It seems our interests do run the same course in this matter. You are aware that any actions I take against the stray Guardsa may not be entirely honorable. Delaunay's gaze drifted over the line of men-at-arms, taking in the veiled features of the Arcadians.
You have sufficient leverage to insist that Vital Bouvard be taken into custody and questioned. He would confess in exchange for his life. Benedict would see that justice was done.
Do you think?
Ah, yes, you are old comrades, aren't you, from the Battle of Three Princes?
Well, perhaps he would, at that. Benedict always had a name as an honourable man. He should never have married into the Caerdicky viper's nest. I swear if it can be done justly, I will do it.
Barquiel Lambert drummed his fingers idly on the elaborate arms of his chair and turned his attention to me.
So you're Childeric's Anguissette, hm? Spying on him for Delaunay's sake?
I curtsied. Your Grace, I am the servant of Nama. My Lord Delaunay merely sought a way to gain your ear. He is grieved at the dissent between you.
Oh, indeed.
A corner of Lambert's mouth twitched in another faint smile.
As grieved as he was at Vital Bouvard's silence, I've no doubt. Well, I'd a mind to see these chits who outwitted one of my best counsellors, and the shrewdest trader in Terre d'Ange, and to see, too, if Delaunay was desperate enough to risk you both. It seems he is.
The violet gaze turned back to Delaunay, thoughtful.
So it's the old promise, is it, Anafiel?
If you would speak of this matter, Your Grace, Delaunay said quietly, I ask that we do it in private.
They don't know. Barquiel Lambert's brows rose, and he laughed aloud.
What loyalty you command! Ah, I'm envious, Anafiel. Then again, those who loved you always did remain true, didn't they? In some measure, at least. What about you?
He looked curiously at Jocelyn. Surely you don't serve him out of love, Carceline. What binds you here?
Steel glinted as Jocelyn bowed.
I am vowed to serve, as Carceil did, Your Grace, he said in his even voice. I, too, take my vows in earnest.
The Duke shook his head, mystified.
They say the old blood runs purer in the provinces. You're Siovalese, lad. Is your house of Shemhazai's line?
Jocelyn hesitated a moment.
A minor house, yes. But I am the middle son, and sworn to Carceil.
Yes, I can see that, Lambert said dryly, then to Delaunay.
Well, it must be nice for you to have a fellow countryman in your household, Anafiel.
Your Grace, Delaunay lifted his brows.
All right, all right, Barquiel Lambert waved his hand. You are dismissed. Beaufort, take them to the kitchens. Bid them well fed. We must not be remiss in attending to our guests. Oh, and give word that Lord Delaunay and his companions are indeed to be considered guests.
He gave a wolfish grin.
No doubt it will set their mind at ease. So, Anafiel Delaunay, shall we converse?
I didn't think I had any appetite after the tension of the day and the audience with the Duke, but I was wrong. We were given a table and served warm crusty bread, sharp cheese, and a good stew. Fit provender for the Duke's men, though not meant for the Duke's table, I guessed. And I set to almost as heartily as Alcuin and Jocelyn.
No one spoke for some time, unavoidably conscious of the presence of Lambert's retainers bustling around the kitchen. Alcuin and I would not have risked it in any case, but we hadn't reckoned with Jocelyn's naivete. On his second helping of stew, he burst out with it, dropping his spoon with a clatter.
"Who is he?" he demanded of us. "There's no House Delaunay in Siobhal. Who is he, and why am I commanded to attend him?"
Alcuin and I exchanged glances and shook our heads warningly at Jocelyn. "Delaunay does not wish to tell us that which could get us killed," I said, adding wryly, "beyond what we already know. If you think perhaps he will confide in a fellow countryman, by all means ask him."
"Maybe I will." There was a stubborn light in Jocelyn's blue eyes.
Alcuin laughed.
"Good luck, Castleen."
Chapter 31. I cannot say what passed between Delaunay and Barquiel Lambert after we were bidden to leave, but it seemed that some form of accord had been reached, albeit an uneasy one. The days of autumn grew shorter, and brought no word save the rumour of Scaldi glimpsed once more in the passes of the Carmeline range. Delaunay waited on the matter's resolution, and once more I cooled my heels, while my coffer stayed empty and my mark grew no longer. I knew there was no malice in it, but even so, it galled me when Alcuin's final appointment with Master Thialar was made and his mark completed. He was free, as I had never been in all my life. Still, it was not in me to be cruel, not to Alcuin. I accompanied him to the Marquist and made all the proper sounds of admiration. Indeed, it was a thing of beauty. The light of the braziers in the Marquist's shop warmed Alcuin's fair skin, and the supple lines emphasized his straight, slender back. The delicate spray of birch leaves that formed the finial ended at the very nape of his neck, where the first down of his white hair began. Master Thialar actually wore a look of satisfaction as he inspected his handiwork, and his apprentice forgot for a moment to blush. Jocelyn, hovering in the background, did blush, looking ill at ease and singularly out of place. When one looks back at one's life, it is easy to mark the turning points. It is not always so easy to know them when they arrive. But this one, I dare say I knew well enough. It had been a long time in coming, and in some part of me I had accepted it. Even so, it was another thing when it happened. I was restless that night, and though I retired early, I found sleep eluded me. Thus it was that I wandered down to the library, with the thought of reading some verse or a diverting tale. When I saw Alcuin slip into the library ahead of me, I nearly went back, being in no mood to be reminded of the change in our status. I don't know why I didn't, save that he had a strange look of resolve, and I was trained to curiosity. As he hadn't seen me, it was a simple matter to stand at an angle to the doorway where the lamplight didn't reach and watch. Delaunay was there, reading. He marked his place with one finger and glanced up as Alcuin entered.
"Yes?"
His tone was polite, but there was reserve in it. I knew Delaunay, and he had not forgotten what I'd told him.
"My lord," Alcuin said softly, "you have not even asked to see my mark finished."
Even from a distance I could see Delaunay blink.
"Master Robert Thialar does excellent work," he said, at something of a loss. "I've no doubt it's well limbed."
"It is." There was a rare amusement in Alcuin's voice. "But, my lord, the debt is not concluded between us until you acknowledge it. Will you see?"
He spoke truly. In keeping with the traditions of the Night Court, the Darwain of the house must acknowledge an adept's mark before it is recorded as finished. How Alcuin knew this, I don't know. It may have been a fortunate guess on his part, though he always surprised me with what he did know. At any rate, Delaunay knew it, and set down his book.
"If you wish," he said formally, rising.
Alcuin turned without a word, unbuttoning the loose shirt he wore and letting it slip off his shoulders. His hair was unbraided, and he gathered it in one hand, drawing it over his shoulder, so it fell white and shining in a thick cable over his chest. His dark eyes were downcast, shadowed by long lashes the colour of tarnished silver. "Is my lord pleased?"
"Alcuin," Delaunay made a sound that might have been a laugh, but wasn't, not quite. He raised his hand, touching the fresh-limbed lines of Alcuin's mark. "Does it hurt?"
"No."
With the simple grace that marked everything he did, Alcuin turned again and laid both arms around Delaunay's neck, raising his gaze to meet Delaunay's.
"No, my lord, it doesn't hurt."
In the hallway I drew in my breath so sharply it hissed between my teeth, though neither heard. Delaunay's hands rose to rest on Alcuin's waist, and I more than half expected him to push Alcuin away. But Alcuin expected it too, and instead tugged Delaunay's head down to kiss him.
"Everything I have done," I heard him whisper, "I have done for you, my lord. Will you not do this one thing for me?"
If Delaunay answered, I did not hear it. I saw that he did not push Alcuin away, and that was enough. A grief I'd not known was in me rose to blind my eyes with tears, and I walked backward, feeling the wall with one hand, wanting to hear no more.
I was no romantic fool to moon over what was not to be, and I had known since my first year of service to Nama that my gifts were not